Hello, it's Dan Le Batard, and we're going to do something a little different this week. We're going to talk to two different people at two different times about the same subject. I was fairly astounded when I heard the numbers of deaths to animals that the Australian fires were causing, when I heard 500 million animals dying in a fire. And this is something that has been noticed in America now, the spread of this death and the destruction that comes with it, where you've got firefighters from America getting standing ovations arriving in Sydney to help with these fires. You've got Mickey Arison of the Miami Heat donating more than $1 million to this cause, because these fires are something that have gotten a lot of people's attention. And so we're going to talk to Ron McGill, the zoo expert that you guys love, at the end of this. But before we get to Ron McGill, we're going to talk to Robinson Meyer of The Atlantic. He covers climate change and science for The Atlantic, and he wrote something specific about the amount of death involved and the consequences of the Great Barrier Reef, half of it dying. These forest fires not ending anytime soon because the weather isn't cooperating. So I wanted to get into that subject a little bit with two people who are experts. Let's start with Robinson Meyer of The Atlantic. So when I read the other day that 500 million animals were perishing in these Australian fires, I wanted to read more about it, learn more about it. And Robinson Meyer, he's a staff writer for The Atlantic. He covers the science, politics, and money of climate change. He had an article that I was reading, and I was interested to learn more. So, Robinson, thank you for being on with us. First things first, can you explain to me what it means? When I heard that number, 500 million animals, I didn't understand what to compare it to, and I didn't understand that number at all, because it sounded like a calamity unlike anything I've heard.
I think it is certainly a calamity. Whenever you have a kind of mass die-off like that, especially fire-related, that basically demolish entire ecosystems at once, just not only kind of lose millions and millions of animals, millions and millions of creatures at the same time, but you also lose the whole, you know, ecosystem that supports them and that kind of makes any one community separate from another. So one big kind of focus that I've been paying attention to, for instance, is that the fires have moved onto an island where there was a protected population of koalas, and I think it's killed about half the koalas on that island. And koalas are affected right now both by this terrible ecosystem change and these fires in Australia, but also by this terrible chlamydia outbreak. And there was no chlamydia on those islands. It was kind of like a safe haven for the koalas. But now there has been a fire there, and actually I think about half of that population has been lost. So we're both losing millions of creatures and also losing some communities that I think scientists had hoped would prove more resilient going forward.
So what happened? Explain to me what happened in Australia.
Australia is having one of the worst fire years in its history. So far, it's lost 25 people at the last report, including a few firefighters, and an area the size of West Virginia. Australia is always prone to fire. It's a little bit like California in that it does, like, bushfires are a part of the ecosystem there, but they are worse now than they used to be, and this is one of the worst years on record for fires in Australia. And they're also made more likely. I mean, part of what we're seeing right now is that bushfires are made more likely by climate change. So when it's warmer, when it's drier, fires are more likely, and 2019 was the warmest and driest year on record in Australia, and so now we're having this horrific fire season.
And how does it get stopped? How does it get slowed? How does it get changed?
Yeah, so there are volunteer firefighters out there, you know, fighting any of the 136 fires that are burning. But mostly, I mean, as with California, you know, you can contain bushfires, but you can't fully extinguish them. You kind of need the weather to cooperate. And right now, the weather is probably not going to cooperate for another month or month and a half. I mean, we're right in the middle of the Australian fire season, and it usually doesn't end till late February. And so there's a huge swath of land that has burned. And of course, once it's burned, it's done burning. Some of the big fires are contained, but to some degree, they're going to be containing as much as they can and trying to deal with spot fires. But the whole, you know, just a number of states, including New South Wales, are going to be experiencing really horrific fire until the fall arrives in a few months and it starts to rain again, and then and it starts to get cooler, and then the environment will put out some of the worst fires.
What is happening to the Great Barrier Reef?
So the Great Barrier Reef, I mean, is kind of the other calamity striking Australia right now. And in some ways, I think if you look at the news over the past few years, we've seen two places where climate change pokes through and causes really near-term calamities. And the first is that this wildfire crisis, and the second is that we're losing some of the most precious ecosystems in the world. In Australia, that's the Great Barrier Reef. So actually marine heat waves, like these are heat waves in the ocean, between 2015 and 2017 are estimated to have killed half the coral in the Great Barrier Reef. And they actually did the most damage to the reef's north, which was also the most protected and kind of the most historically best preserved. And so the reef, due to also extreme heat, but a completely different kind of extreme heat, is also just being completely scoured right now. And we're losing stuff in the reef that will probably never come back.
What, for example, can America do to stop what is happening to a deteriorating world?
What America could do as a country, and it's going to go back to specific policies, but it's to pass some kind of price on carbon. That would be very fast, and it would propagate through the whole economy quickly and drive down a lot of emissions and encourage other countries to drive down their emissions too. The other thing that it can do is spend a lot of money, frankly, to remake infrastructure and to switch over all the plants that we have right now that are coal plants or natural gas plants to zero carbon energy, to switch over the transportation system, probably by incentivizing electric car purchases, to zero carbon energy, and then to move through the rest of the economy through farms and industry, and to really look and say, where are carbon emissions coming from and how can we drive them out?
Robinson, you cover the science, politics, and money of climate change. You're covering scientists, and I don't know how you're not running into the sea screaming at every turn, hey, we're destroying the world, and 50 years from now, the world's going to be on fire because it's already on fire. Like, you must be talking to people and must be alarmed at how little attention is being paid to the things that you're actually concerning yourself with.
Yes. I would say what I've been struck by over the past 2 years is how much science that I covered as a future prediction is now coming to pass, such that we've basically had this unbroken global fire season from the Brazil Amazon fires to the California fires and now to Australia fires. Like, there's been mass wildfires raging for the past, you know, 7 to 8 months, basically unbroken and just passing through the world with the summer. And with the hottest temperatures, I think the only reason, as a reporter, it's an exceptionally frustrating thing to publish, to cover, because it just doesn't get the attention that it should. It isn't on politicians' radars like it should. People still believe really false things about it. But the reason one doesn't is because this is just something that people are going to deal with no matter what. We're either going to deal with it now and spend a little bit of money and preserve a lot of the Earth's natural beauty and a lot of its kind of productive carrying capacity, or we're going to deal with it in the future and have to spend a lot more money and be stuck with a much more depleted planet. And who knows when we're going to finally start taking it seriously, but we have to deal with it no matter what. And so every day you come to work and try to deal with it. And we'd much rather deal with it now than later.
Can you explain to me, based on the people that you're talking to, the investigating that you do, the expertise that you're getting from others, you imagine if we do not change, if we don't make substantive change, either in policy or in resources, that what is going to be different about America and the world in 2050, for example?
There will be dozens, if not hundreds, first of all, of animals that we're just used to hearing about, that we grow up as children, surround us, they go on Noah's Ark, that will be extinct and that we will not get back. That's the first absolute thing. The second thing is that the world will be a far less stable place if we're lucky. It will be a place where it's harder to grow crops in many of the most populated regions of the planet. It's a place where there will be less water in places that need water, including in the American West and Southwest. It will be a place where there are days, including in the Midwest, including throughout the United States, and certainly throughout the tropics, where it will be dangerous to go outside, where you will actually be taking your life in your hands by going outside, because it will be so hot that your body will start to break down. What I'd say is it's a little hard to answer this question, because those are all the parts of the world I can tell you about that are based in physical systems and that I can like describe how we know they'll progress.
I want to thank you for your time, but it's depressing. Everything, every syllable out of your mouth is more depressing than the last one.
I mean, I'd say that thank you so much, first of all, for having me. And second of all, this is a fixable challenge, especially in the United States. This is something the United States should absolutely be leading on. These are technological solutions, and we are still the technological leader in the world. And the more we can talk about that and the more we can move it to the center of our politics in the same way trying to figure out how to deal with healthcare or trying to figure out how to deal with transportation or roads or any of these other kind of bread and butter political issues, the more that it's at the center of that, like, the better off hopefully we'll be, and the better we'll come to understand what we need to do as a country.
Less depressing, but still terribly depressing. So we'll let you go on that note. Thank you for being on with us. We appreciate the depression.
Hey, absolutely. Thanks. I'm always happy to provide it.
Our thanks to Robinson Meyer for spending that time with us, talking to us about what's happening with these Australian fires. That's the science of it from a reporter from The Atlantic. But let's segue into Ron McGill, our zoo expert. You guys have heard him for a long time here on the show. He's fairly mortified by everything happening with these Australian fires. So we're going to talk to him here. But before we do that, Mike, tell him who's sponsoring this week's South Beach Sessions.
Dan, it's once again brought to you by ZipRecruiter. It's a new year and you want to keep growing your team, but you need the right tools to help keep your hiring streamlined and efficient. That's where ZipRecruiter.com/beach comes in. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to help find the right people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. And as those applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each and every one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
They've been supporting us since the beginning, and we ask you to support the people who support us. One of those people is Ron McGill. Here he is. Ron McGill is with us now to talk about a variety of things. But I wanted to start first with the koala bear. You just had one born at your zoo, right? That's a pretty rare thing.
Yeah, it's very rare for us. First time in over 28 years that we've had a successful birth of a koala. It's not a bear, Dan. It's just koalas. A koala bear, I don't know where that comes from. I think it's a teddy bear thing, but it has nothing to do with bears. Just koala. And it was born here, and it's only the third successful birth we've had in the history of the zoo, and the first one in close to 3 decades.
How does that go? How many failures are involved? Like, what happens there?
Well, what happens is, you know, the koalas are marsupials, so their pregnancy is very short. They give birth to a baby that is basically hairless, has non-developed eyes, tiny vestigial limbs. It looks like the size of a bumblebee, and it's born after only about 30 days. And it comes out of the birth canal, and then it has a very dangerous journey where it has to crawl into the pouch on its own. The mother doesn't help it. If it falls down, it's going to die. The mother's not going to pick it up and put it in the pouch. So it's a very dangerous journey up into that pouch where it locks onto a nipple in the pouch, and the pouch acts like a secondary uterus where the baby, it's called the Joey, continues to develop in the pouch for the next 6 months or so before it finally sticks its head out and it looks like a baby koala. But during that development in the pouch, those 5-6 months are incredibly precarious for the animal. There's so many things that can happen, and we here at the zoo have lost several Joeys during that pouch time, so they never were able to come out of the pouch successfully. So it is a dangerous time for the animal.
Why is the koala mom such an asshole about picking up her kids when they fall down?
You know, it's that she doesn't know, and theoretically, if you look at a koala's hands, their claws make it almost impossible to pick up this baby. When I'm telling you, it is the size of a bumblebee. It looks like a newborn rat. If you've ever seen these, what they call pinkies, that's exactly what it looks like. You would never think it was a koala when you see it. And there's really almost no way for the mother to pick it up and put it into the pouch. So, and it's also kind of nature's survival of the fittest. The assumption being, well, if that baby wasn't strong enough to find its way into the pouch, it probably doesn't have the strength that it needs to develop to be a good, healthy adult in the first place.
For the people who weren't listening to the radio show when we talked about some of this in a glancing fashion, the fires are what kind of threat to the koala in Australia?
Well, they're a huge threat. First of all, koalas are found in eucalyptus forests because that's what koalas feed on, eucalyptus trees. There's many different species of eucalyptus trees, but they feed on their trees. They're arboreal animals. They spend almost all their lives up in the trees, only coming down to go from one tree to the next. And eucalyptus is one of the most flammable trees on the planet. As a matter of fact, they're so flammable that the state of California has now made it illegal to plant eucalyptus because of the fire threats in California with the droughts that are happening out there. So this is a very flammable plant. Happens to be the food of the koala, so it's not like you can't have eucalyptus. So when these fires start, they go so rapidly. The koala is a very slow animal. This is not an animal that can outrun anything. First of all, they sleep almost 20 hours a day because of the way they have to metabolize that eucalyptus. They have a very slow metabolism. They sleep 20 hours a day. When there's a fire, usually they're up in a tree, and the fire just prevents them from coming down when they come down. That's why you have so many horrible images of these koalas being burned. So for koalas, fire is catastrophic. Now, you have to understand, the fire is a normal process of the health of the environment in Australia. The problem is now with these extreme droughts, with the fact that they haven't in a lot of these areas actually tended to these forests in a way to backburn them on a regular series that we do here in Florida, for instance, to burn these forests to keep them healthy so you don't have an exorbitant amount of fuel that grows underneath these forests, which makes the fires even worse. So there needs to be a combination of, you know, less of these climate extremes and more of preventative medicine when it comes to protecting the forests.
Can you explain to the layman who doesn't understand exactly the size of the calamity that we're talking about here that doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon because they need the help of the weather and the weather's not cooperating?
It's catastrophic. There's no way to underscore this other than say it is catastrophic because they're saying, and this is conservative, Dan, this is very conservative, 500 million animals have been harmed or killed by the fires so far. There are other estimates that are going over 1 billion that just came out yesterday. I mean, when you think of that number, think about that. It's such a mind-boggling number. Now, of course, this includes everything, not just koalas and kangaroos, and you know, but it includes lizards, it includes amphibians, it includes birds. They're saying now there may be a couple of species that have gone extinct because of these fires. You know, Australia is such a unique petri dish of wildlife. 80% of the wildlife that's found there is found nowhere else in the world. It's kind of like an island that's grown on itself, and all these animals have evolved to be unique to themselves. So that's what makes this so tragic.
What are we going to lose? What are the animal kingdoms that you think will not come out of this?
Well, I think, you know, when you talk about something like a koala, I don't think the koala is going to go extinct, but I would be really surprised if after this is all over, it is not placed on the endangered list. And that's really incredible to think an animal that was really common throughout Australia is now endangered because of these fires. So when you try to put a face on that, you put a face of the koala because that's what people can relate to. There are certain isolated populations of koalas that have become extinct in certain territories in Australia. They have already determined, yes, the populations of koalas in these territories have become extinct, and that's detrimental for the overall population of koalas because the genetic diversity is being eliminated. You're minimizing that gene pool, which then brings up problems of inbreeding and all kinds of problems that later on can be very detrimental for the species. So I think when you talk about, you know, koalas becoming endangered, you know, kangaroos can run, they can outrun most fires, but their habitat is being destroyed. So what do they have to go back to? You know, the hope is here that the rains come quickly. If the rains can come quickly, things will grow back quickly. I don't have too much fear about that. But you know, the weather's changing so much. People talk about global warming. It's not necessarily global warming. It's climate change, where we have extremes. We have extreme cold. We have extreme heat. We have extreme drought. We have extreme rains. And extremism in any form is dangerous.
What ecosystem is going to be changed so much that it frightens you a little bit? Like the enduring echoing problems that come environmentally with losing a species or having a species endangered?
Sure. Well, it's going to be, you know, the forests are the first things that come to mind. These huge eucalyptus forests, these forests that are homes to so many animals. When you think about what has the greatest biodiversity as far as ecosystems go in the world, you know, it's the rainforest, it's the coral reefs. Well, those forests of Australia, that's the greatest biodiversity of Australia. Australia is a very arid continent. There's a lot of dry desert areas in Australia. But when you get into these forests, that's where the biodiversity is. And Dan, the bottom line is every one of those species is connected to the other. You know, whether it be a pollinator that's pollinating fruits and plants that other animals feed on, whether it be another animal that is eating seeds and by flying is dispersing those seeds by passing it through its digestive system and planting those seeds in other places to keep an ecosystem going. All these things are connected. And, you know, I don't think there's anyone that can really anticipate all of the connections. I mean, there's so many things. I'll go as far as to say we don't know a lot more than we know. But what we do know is that there is a connection to all of these things. And when one of those links in the chain is broken, the chain is compromised tremendously. And, you know, we can only hope that nature can rebound from this. But it is so profound. It is so catastrophic what is happening there now that, you know, hopefully it's opening some eyes. Because, Dan, it's not just Australia, and I know I'm going out on a little bit of a limb here. Australia is kind of like a canary right now. It's the canary in the coal mine. It's a big red flag to the rest of the planet of what is happening here. We're seeing these extreme events, whether it be floods, whether it be fires, whether it be droughts. We're seeing these extreme events around the planet. And understand that this planet is not defined by political boundaries. We are all connected. What happens in Antarctica affects directly what happens here in South Florida. And people, once they can get a grasp of that concept, I think they'll pay more attention as to what they have to do to help preserve it.
You have mentioned in the past that your knowledge of the sea isn't quite what your knowledge of land is, but what can you tell us about the ecosystem damage and danger that many, many animals are dying on this reef, that the Great Barrier Reef is being harmed in big ways by everything that's happening here? And the Great Barrier Reef is what to the world's ecosystem?
The Great Barrier Reef is one of, if not the most diverse, biodiverse reef in the world. More than half of it has died off. In many areas, it has died off. You're looking at the loss of biodiversity that is so huge. And yes, I wouldn't be surprised if these fires are also causing a detrimental effect, because all the smoke, all the emissions that are coming from those fires into the air is then absorbed by the water that then affected the reefs. This is all, it's a domino effect, Dan. And people don't put those things together and they don't understand. The reef is the rainforest of the ocean. And the bottom line is this, we know less about the ocean than we know about the moon. The ocean takes up the overwhelming majority of our planet. This is where we get so much food, so many nutrients, so many things. The ocean it's the heart. It's the heart of our planet. And because we don't live in the ocean, we don't pay as much attention as we should to it. But this is huge. We are losing reefs, not just the Great Barrier Reef. Right here in Florida, we're seeing reef die-offs at an exponential rate because of chemicals, of pollutants, of fossil fuels going into the air and polluting the ocean. The things that are happening with plastics in our ocean, it's obscene when you can see, Dan, the animals that I have seen dead, you know, everything from small birds to full-grown whales with, you know, ounces to hundreds of pounds of plastics in their gut that have killed them. People need to understand there are consequences to what we're doing with these things.
When you mention the Great Barrier Reef losing, half of its strength, is it in danger? Like, is there the possibility that within our lifetimes we'll lose the entirety of the reef?
I mean, I think there's certainly a possibility. I hope it's not a probability. I hope that these wake-up calls are bringing people a call to action that will help change these things. But, you know, if people were to look up and see how much of that reef has been lost, I think they'll be blown away. Because we always hear about the Great Barrier Reef and we hear all these great stories about it and the romanticized visions of it. The Great Barrier Reef is struggling. And any marine biologist who's been out there and has been studying it will be the first to carry that flag and tell you how desperate it is that we pay attention to try to protect that.
And what happens? What happens if it just goes away, if it dies?
Well, it's all, you know, these are feeding grounds. not only nurseries for fish, they're feeding grounds for other fish, and that becomes a domino effect. All of a sudden, your fisheries start to deplete. You lose that food source. All of a sudden, there's not enough fish not just to feed human beings, but to feed the birds to feed in the fish. And the birds to feed in the fish start to either die off, where they're no longer spreading seeds, they're no longer doing different things that they normally are dependent on to do. I mean, I hate to sound so redundant. It's a domino effect. It's just one affects another species, which affects another species, and there's no way to predict of how far out that reaches. I hate to sound like such an alarmist because, I say extremism in any form is dangerous, but man, the world needs to wake up. We are facing some serious issues that once we lose a species, just one species, all the money in the world isn't going to bring it back. And that effect that it has on other species and eventually on us, Dan, that's, you know, unfortunately, that's when people pay attention, when there's a direct effect on us. But we have to try to wake up people to make them understand that we got to nip this in the bud, and it's beyond the bud now. It's grown to a much greater extent than just being a bud. But it's going to affect us, Dan. It's going to affect us as a human race.
If you're listening to this and you're frustrated by the helplessness involved with it, one of the ways that you can help, and this is not the reason that we're doing this, but Ron McGill happens to run one of my favorite charities and does a lot of good work in terms of, with his endowment, helping the animals, and you know that your money is going directly. It's not getting caught in a bureaucracy. Explain to the people how it is, Ron, that they can help with what it is that you do, and explain to them the specifics of why it is that you eliminate the bureaucracy and make sure that that money goes straight to the animals.
Well, Dan, you know, I've been working at the zoo for 40 years, but I didn't come to work at the zoo to work for an attraction. Zoos spend millions of dollars building new exhibits, new attractions within their facilities. But my concern, my number one priority, is conservation in the wild. In a perfect world, Dan, we wouldn't need any zoos because everybody would be able to see these animals in the wild. To me, it would be horrifically sad if the zoo was the last place in the world you could see an animal. So having said that, I established an endowment here at the zoo because I was frustrated. I just thought that we weren't doing enough with animals in the wild. And the endowment raises money, and that money can only be spent on conservation work in the field. It is not to pay any salaries. It does not go to administrative costs. It's to buy radio collars. It's to buy camera traps. It's to help in equipment. We've purchased vehicles, research vehicles for work out in the conservation. The bottom line is every penny of that endowment, when people make a donation to the endowment, it stays as part of the endowment. So the endowment then produces dividends, which then are used to do conservation work in the field. So that endowment, the main purpose of it is sustainability. Nobody can touch the corpus of that endowment, which now stands at close to $2 million, but it produces well over $100,000 a year that goes just to conservation work to help protect animals in the wild where they belong.
Where do people find it?
You can go to zoomiami.org and look for the Ron McGill Conservation Endowment. They'll be able to donate that way, and it's a totally tax-deductible donation.
Ron, thank you. Always appreciate the time, sir.
Thank you, Dan. Have a good one. Take care.
Thank you, buddy.
All right, man. I really appreciate the time, Dan.
Yeah, and no, I appreciate it.
I mean, this is some serious shit that's happening here, brother. It really is.
Wow. If it makes Ron McGill curse, you realize we have arrived. You love
it
to
really
say Jiminy Christmas. You love to say all sorts of lame things. I don't think I've ever heard you curse before.
But Dan, it's serious.
It is serious.
I hope it's a wake-up call to people because people got to get out of their own little bubble and understand that all this stuff is connected, man. It's just a matter of time.
Thank you, buddy.
Take care. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
All right. Tried something different this week. Hope I can't say you enjoyed it because that wasn't very enjoyable, but hope that you appreciated that it was something different. If you don't, that's okay, too. Rate, review, and subscribe as someone who supports all things Lebatard and Friends. And you can criticize, too, because we want to hear your feedback on that stuff. But we need the support of rating, subscribing, and reviewing so we can keep bringing you some of the things that we've been bringing you, like Mike Ryan. What do we have on this week's Mystery Crate? What are we doing?
Well, I can't give it away, Dan, as mystery is in its name. But some of the things that you could hear on Mystery Crate week to week is Izzy Gutierrez and Stu Gatz weighing in on parenting, ranging to Mike Golic Jr. giving you a full breakdown of sneakers, to the other week, Mike Golic Jr. and the boys talking some Bachelor. It is a fun show. If you're a fan of the show, it's really geared towards the diehards of the Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz. And if you're a fan of that and what we do on the Local Hour, you will love Mystery Crate because it's not just us. We bring in personalities in and around
it's our all
show.
The friends around. All the show friends f***ing around.
That's a great way to describe it. I mean, you didn't have to say that cuss word, but it's fine. Subscribe, rate, review to that. Thanks again for
your
support.
It's slightly more uplifting than what we just did. Slightly. It's slightly more laughs than slightly. What we just did.
Slightly, but we can kill a half a billion animals on this week's episode of Mystery Crate. You never know. That's the fun in it.